DW Deutsche Welle. World Link.
Hello and welcome to this edition of DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early. On this week's show, how the Kurdish diaspora is flocking to Iraq to fight back against the terrorist group IS.
We also visit a hospital in East Jerusalem that is treating victims of the Gaza war and speak to one of Israel's most respected and most hated journalists.
It went so far that my newspaper had to hire a bodyguard to accompany me when I walk in the streets of Tel Aviv. A lot of support, but much more hatred, aggression, lack of tolerance and cursing everywhere I go.
These stories and more coming up on Worldlink.
You're listening to DW's World Link. I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early.
A small team of Americans, military and civilian, completed their review of the conditions on the mountain. They found that food and water have been reaching those in need and that thousands of people have been evacuating safely each and every night. The civilians who remain continue to leave, aided by Kurdish forces and Yazidis who are helping to facilitate the safe passage of their families.
U.S. President Barack Obama there speaking about American efforts to secure the safe passage of thousands of displaced Yazidi. They have been trapped on an Iraqi mountain following the onslaught of the terrorist group Islamic State. The advance of IS across northern and western Iraq has triggered a major humanitarian crisis in recent months. An estimated 1.2 million people have fled the Islamic militants, who have been executing, crucifying and beheading civilians and members of religious minorities in what resembles an ethnic cleansing campaign designed to establish an Islamic caliphate straddling Iraq and Syria. The US have been bombing IS targets in Iraq in a bid to stop their advance, and some Western states have decided to supply arms to help the hard-pressed Kurdish forces in northern Iraq repulse the militants.
When Islamic State militants took the town of Makmur earlier this month, Kurdish fighters withdrew to a small base camp in the nearby village of Bazaga, waiting for orders to launch a counter-offensive. Hermione G has visited the camp and encountered some of the different groups that have come together from around the world to defend the Kurdistan region from the Islamic State onslaught.
As you approach Makmur from the Kurdistan regional capital Erbil, it's easy to know when you've arrived at Bazaga because of the sudden appearance of hundreds of cars lining the side of the road, apparently in the middle of nowhere. Young men lean against their cars, clearly waiting for something. In fact, like the security forces stationed nearby, they're waiting for their chance to take on Islamic State militants, or Daesh, as they're known here.
We come here, we want to fight terrorists. We have gun in the car here. We fight with these people till we die. My name is Mukaddam Aziz. I live in Norway, in Oslo. Come back because this fighting here, because this terrorist, because Daesh.
Aziz is not alone. Many of the other volunteers standing around in the late afternoon heat have also returned to Kurdistan from abroad since the Islamic State took control of the city of Mosul in June. Cameron's family is from Erbil, but he now lives in the United States.
I just came back. I'm Kurdish. I have to defend my country. You know what I mean?
And that seems to be the overriding view amongst the newly returned volunteers. It's still their country, even if they don't live here anymore. And they're willing to fight for it.
We won't fight them. You don't have no religion. You don't have no country. These people have no nothing. He's losing nothing. We lose. We have patrol. We have good life. We have beautiful city. We have beautiful country. This Daesh coming here from Syria, from Lebanon, from Chechnya, from Afghanistan. Why fighting in my country?
At a small base camp nearby, men mill around, some in uniform, some in traditional Kurdish dress, but all sharing the same mood of restless anticipation. They fill the time talking and smoking, apparently oblivious to the intermittent artillery fire in the background. Commander Hajar of the Makmur Asayish, or Kurdish Security Services, is in charge of the base. He says his forces clashed with the Islamic State the day before, killing 40 militants.
We brought the bodies of two men back to the camp and buried them this morning. One was Iraqi. We think the other one was Pakistani, but he didn't have an ID on him, so we're not sure. They have good weapons, but they're not good fighters. We have good fighters. They are here, and they're ready to die. If only we had the weapons, we could break the terrorists.
Siraj and Aram are amongst Commander Hajjar's troops, both in their early 20s and from Erbil. They're friends from law school. Siraj has already graduated, but Aram is still finishing his studies. He should be sitting an exam this week, but decided to come and fight instead. Unlike the Iraqi soldiers who abandoned their posts in Mosul and Tikrit, in the face of the Islamic State forces, Siraj says Kurds want to fight for their homeland.
The Iraqis have corrupt leaders, corrupt commanders, and the people don't want to fight for them. As Kurds, there's a good connection between the people and the government, our leaders. We believe in our commanders, we believe in our people, and that's why we fight for them.
And Kurds also have a common goal, Aram explains.
The Kurds have been fighting for years. We never run away. They shell us sometimes with mortars, but we're not scared. In all our families, we have a martyr, and we are also ready to die for this country and be martyrs. We're all working toward an independent state, and we're ready to die for that dream.
While Kurds around the world do all share that dream, they don't always agree on the best way to reach it, leading to different factions and political parties, and occasionally even bloody conflict, such as the Kurdish Civil War of the mid-1990s. One of the most powerful Kurdish groups of recent years is the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, founded by Abdullah Öcalan in the 1970s. Öcalan, known to his followers as APO, is now in prison in Turkey, serving a life sentence for treason. And the PKK is still considered a terrorist organization by the US, Europe, and NATO. A hero to many Kurds in Turkey, there's little love lost between him and the current leadership of Iraqi Kurdistan, who he sees as having betrayed the dream of establishing a greater Kurdistan across Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey. But fighting alongside the Asayish forces this week are hundreds of PKK fighters. While many are seasoned guerrillas with years of experience fighting the Turkish military, there are also young people, as well as many women, amongst their ranks. One of those women is 28-year-old Slau. Wearing the loose cotton trousers that are the hallmark of traditional Kurdish male clothing, with a grenade strapped onto her brightly coloured cummerbund. This is her first experience of armed combat, but she says she feels prepared.
I've seen it on TV. I've been watching it on TV since I was a child. Apple says if you have an aim, a goal, a will, you can fight for it. We were brought up with that ideology to protect ourselves for ourselves.
And she says there's an upside to the current crisis.
It's the first time I've seen all the Kurds working together and fighting together, so it's a great experience for me. Now there are no borders between the different parts of Kurdistan. Kurds from Iran, Syria, Turkey and Iraq are here. We've all crossed the borders to fight the Daesh. The Kurds are united to bring our land back under our control. We have to protect our honour and our dignity with our guns.
Hemani G sent us that report from Bazaga.
More than 1,900 people have been killed in Gaza since the war between Israel and the blockaded strip's ruling party Hamas broke out 5 weeks ago. The Israeli army has lost 64 soldiers and argues several hundreds of those who make up the total Gazan death toll were Hamas-affiliated fighters. But hundreds of others killed in the strip were innocent civilians, including at least 450 children, while the total number of those injured is approaching 10,000.
A small number have been transferred out of the strip to Palestinian hospitals in East Jerusalem, and over 40 critical care patients have received treatment at the Makassed Islamic Charitable Society Hospital. Camilla Schick reports.
We In the pediatrics ward lies a small child named Yaman. He lost a brother, sister, and both his parents. He has one sister left and his grandfather, who says after their home was bombarded, he thought everybody had died. When rescuers searched through the rubble, they found no one, he says. Then at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, he was told they had taken in an orphaned child. He asked the child, "Who are you?" And the child responded, "I'm Yaman." He says his grandson's face was so blackened by the dust and burns that he had not even recognized him. In another room, Dr. Samia Al-Kurd struggles to hold back tears after introducing us to the uncle of 14-year-old Saja, who now lies in a coma. Saja is about to undergo major surgery to stop internal bleeding and to reconstruct part of her skull. Saja?
Okay.
The doctor's just showing us a passport photo of Saja from her uncle.
يعني أنا جيت بدل الوالد مرفوض أمني من قبل إسرائيل.
Saja's uncle explains her father was disallowed a permit to travel with her to Jerusalem, while Saja's mother stayed in Gaza to support her other siblings. Saja was the only one in their family who was injured after her room was struck by an Israeli missile in Beit Lahia in the north of the Strip. The piece of shrapnel which penetrated her skull may well have left her permanently brain damaged. In the corridor stand a number of Palestinian teenage boys from Jerusalem who are holding gift bags filled with toys and clothes for the Gazan children. They say they have bought all of this with their own pocket money. One tells me he and his friends have already visited 15 children here.
We are with Gaza and everything we have, and we will give them our souls and our bodies and our money.
The transfer of the few patients who are able to get a permit to temporarily leave Gaza is funded by the Palestinian Authority and in coordination with the Israeli authorities. Dr. Samir says each patient is permitted to travel with one relative from the Strip. The relatives sleep on mattresses on the floor of the hospital's waiting areas. The hospital does its best to provide them with food and clothing, she says, while money to help assist in their comfort is donated by the Bank of Palestine as well as local Palestinians.
The companions are not allowed to leave the wall of the hospital. So as you can see where they are sleeping, and when the injured patient finishes his treatment, we do another one-day permit for the companion to go back. If they find them anywhere, they get deported.
The doctor holds back from crying yet again as she tells me another patient, 32-year-old Mohammed, who had his left hand amputated and whose whole body was badly burnt, had passed away that morning, just hours after arriving at the hospital.
And he passed away just an hour ago. Maybe if you like to wait in half an hour, usually we do the funeral for them, so you can stay for the funeral.
Okay. Shortly after, we head down five flights of stairs and outside for the hospital's goodbye funeral for Mohammed. Now we're outside in the blistering heat of Jerusalem. The hospital's director, Dr. Rafiq Husseini, stands waiting with a crowd of medical staff and locals who've come to pay their respects.
Allahu Akbar!
How difficult was it for people to get to Jerusalem from the Gaza Strip?
It was difficult. We only got a trickle of people to come every day. So we are hoping that more people will come because there are 3,000 injured kids, there are 2,000 injured women, 5,000 injured men in Gaza. So we're hoping that there will be many more that we can treat and keep alive rather than send, unfortunately, back dead to Gaza.
How many Gazans went to Israeli hospitals?
None.
And that was by choice?
By choice.
Now they're bringing the body out. The body's wrapped in the Palestinian flag. So now the men are standing in lines facing the body of the patient who's being taken back to the Gaza Strip, holding their hands up to the sky and touching their brow in Islamic prayer. Now they're raising the Palestinian flags up again. Back upstairs, I meet a man in his 30s named Hassan. He's been here for 2 weeks after being transferred from Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital to undergo further surgery on his fractured leg. He tells me he fled Shujair in the east of the strip after the Israeli army warned civilians to vacate the neighborhood. He fled to his sister's flat in the Rimal neighborhood of Gaza City, where he stayed with 11 other people, including his family. But he says two missiles later struck the apartment building, killing his mother, sister, his wife, and two children. Dr. Samir informs me Hassan's wife had been pregnant at the time. What was happening in Gaza City when this happened? Was there any warning? Anybody getting any phone calls?
Actually, no. We received phone calls when we were staying at a Shujaia neighborhood. They said that you should move to the center of Gaza City because it will be a safer place. But the fact it was not. We was suddenly hit. No warnings, no phone calls, nothing.
Was there any explanation afterwards as to why the Israelis targeted this building?
We don't have any explanation why we were targeted. We don't have any affiliations. We don't have any political views. We were just normal citizens.
Do you want to go back to Gaza?
Yeah, sure. I will go back to Gaza because I still have two sisters and two brothers, and I have my father. And yeah, and I work there. So I am a banker, by the way. My life is there. Despite the fact that I lost the whole of my family, I lost my wife, my two children, and I lost my mother, my sister. Actually, I don't have any place to go. My hope for Gaza is for the international community to stand for its rules. They should recognize Gaza. They should recognize the people of Gaza as a people that have the right to live, that have the right to be part of the Palestinian state.
There was a unity government between Fatah and Hamas before this war broke out. Do you want to see that unity government to succeed and to unite the West Bank and Gaza? Or?
Of course, yeah. This is the hope of all Palestinians in the diaspora and in the Palestinian territories. We all hope that we become a united people, and there should be a geographic continuity between West Bank and Gaza. And we are hopeful that an independent state should be established here.
Shukran, thank you.
Camilla Sheikh sent us that report from East Jerusalem. And staying in the region, we now turn to Tel Aviv, where one of Israel's most acclaimed journalists has been receiving death threats over his coverage of the Gaza war. Gideon Levy, who works for Israel's leading liberal Haaretz newspaper, is not one to mince his words, frequently condemning Israel's settlement policy as well as its treatment of the Palestinians in general.
The seasoned journalist who's been branded a traitor by some Israelis is used to criticism, abuse and even threats. But he's never felt so threatened as in recent weeks, which is why his newspaper has now hired a bodyguard for him who accompanies him everywhere he goes. Earlier, I spoke to him on Skype from Tel Aviv. I started by asking him just how difficult it is for him to do his job these days.
In ordinary days, it's quite tough, but what happened in the last months, ever since this war started, is more like a witch hunt rather than a real democratic society. It went so far that my newspaper had to hire a bodyguard to accompany me when I walk in the streets of Tel Aviv. A lot of support, but much more hatred, aggression, lack of tolerance, and cursing everywhere I go.
You used to believe in a two-state solution, but now you've shifted to a one-state solution. Could you please explain why?
I still believe in the two-state solution, but I think that we missed this train. And I think that continuing to dream about it or to negotiate about it is just a mean to waste more time. Because with 500,000 settlers, with total non-Israeli willingness to give up the occupied territories, with those conditions, you will never get to a viable Palestinian state. And if not so, one should direct his energy toward the alternative. And the alternative is a democratic civilian state with equal rights, with one vote, one man, one vote. I don't think this will be an easy job, but it's the only alternative which is still left on the table.
So what exactly would such a one-state solution look like in terms of borders, and what would it entail?
The borders is the easy part. The borders will be the entire Palestine or the entire land of Israel from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. The borders are the less problem. The problem is, will Palestinians and Jews be able to overcome all the hatred and the demonization and dehumanization and fears? And will they be able really to live together, or will it turn into another Yugoslavia? This is still to be seen. Right now, in the present atmosphere, it is an utopia. I know it. But I don't see any alternative, as I said before.
Mr. Levy, how can Israel negotiate or broker a peace with a group like Hamas that does not recognize Israel's right to exist?
First of all, you negotiate peace only with enemies, and with the most bitter enemies. Also, the PLO was once exactly in the same position, and it changed. And I believe that also in the Hamas, there are some reasonable people who want to achieve some achievements for their people. And yes, right now, Hamas is a very tough negotiator. But I would like to ask you, what is the alternative to the Hamas? The Hamas is running Gaza, and the Hamas is there to stay. And the alternative to Hamas might become a Somalia in Gaza, and the Israelis know it. And therefore, by the way, they don't try to crush the Hamas totally, because they know that the alternative will be much worse. So if the Hamas is there to stay, and I still think that the Hamas is a national religious organization, and it's not a jihad, the world jihad organization like people try to describe it, not yet. So we should challenge them and try. And I believe that also there we might find a partner, and we don't have any alternative but to negotiate with them. By the way, Israel is negotiating with them right now when we speak.
Mr. Levy, if we look at the broader picture, the entire Middle East is in upheaval. There's definitely a radicalization in the Arab world. I mean, if we just look at the rise of groups like ISIS, for instance, given this whole setup that things seem to be reaching critical mass, how hopeful are you for the future of Israel?
My main concern about Israel's future is the domestic arena and not the countries around Israel. What's going on around Israel is not necessarily dangerous for Israel, because right now most of the Arab countries are much more preoccupied with their own domestic struggles and not with Israel. So that's exactly the time to try and to get agreements with those and peaceful relations with those who are still moderate around. And that's exactly the time to put an end to the occupation, try to get to an agreement with the Palestinians, because this is the core of all the relations of Israel with its neighbors.
Mr. Levy, perhaps if we end on a personal note, as you said at the beginning, your views and staunch criticism of Israeli government policy have earned you countless threats and abuse, including death threats, and you now have a bodyguard when you leave the house. Given these developments, have you ever considered leaving Israel?
Not even for a second. I was born here, and that's my place, and that's the place that I'm struggling for. I even consider myself as an Israeli patriot, even though most of the Israelis will not accept this definition. But it is all about the care of the future of this place. It's all about the desire to live in a place which is a just place. And a sentiment that I can't share right now, because I don't feel that I live in a just country who makes justice with its neighbors, mainly with the Palestinians. So as long as it will be possible for me to stay here and to raise my voice, I will not even hesitate for a second. I will continue to be here, because I belong to here not less than any other of my fellow Israelis.
Gideon Levy talking to me from Tel Aviv there. You're listening to DW's WorldLink, where I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early.
This is DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Samantha Early. In this second half of the show, as more medical workers succumb to the Ebola virus in West Africa, we find out why some choose to stay and fight.
We also get to know one of Pakistan's power players as the country marked its Independence Day with mass protests.
And we meet the wacky women of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Things happen here late at night, don't they, in Edinburgh? Last night, 2 o'clock in the morning, I was walking home. I got wolf whistled by a tramp, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, yes, I did. And it's amazing how you can sort of turn things around to your way of thinking, can't you? Because I looked at that man sitting in a puddle of his own making, with one tooth rattling lonely in his head, with his life savings in a takeaway box on his lap. And I thought, you might not have always made the right life choices, but you've certainly got a keen eye when it comes to the ladies.
All this and more coming up in the next half hour here on WorldLink.
The Ebola virus has continued its deadly spread across West Africa and beyond, triggering travel warnings and border closures. So far, more than 1,000 people have succumbed to the highly contagious disease. Some of the most at risk are health workers themselves, with a second top Ebola doctor in Sierra Leone, Dr. Modupe Cole, among those to die this week.
Earlier, I spoke with Dr. Oliver Johnson, the program director for King's Health Partners, which works alongside hospitals in Sierra Leone, including Connaught Hospital in Freetown, where Dr. Cole worked. While their work is centred on helping strengthen the country's health system, they've since found themselves working to organise and support staff at the front lines. I began by asking Dr. Johnson why he and his colleagues have chosen to stay when other organisations have left.
Part of it is because King's Health Partners, we don't consider ourselves an NGO, we consider ourselves a partnership. And so we consider Connaught Hospital to be a partner, the staff here to be our own colleagues. Many of us have been living in Sierra Leone for a while and see people across this city and this country as friends and family, really. We don't come with an agenda. So it's very natural when a new problem arose for us to say, right, OK, we're in this together. What can we do to support your efforts? The volunteers out here at the moment, when they signed up, this is not what they signed up for. So it's also been a personal decision from the volunteers that they wanted to stay. And I think it's shown enormous commitment. It's been the volunteers fighting to ensure that they were allowed to stay, because these are our colleagues, and all of our instincts have been to stay as long as we can and as long as it's safe.
And you're talking about your colleagues and the volunteers making those decisions, but you've had to make those decisions for yourself as well. What's gone through your mind? And given the deaths of some of your colleagues, have you since had second thoughts?
There are certainly moments where I've woken up and thought, wow, this is a terrifying disease and this is a terrifying situation. The risk is real. But one thing that makes this risk of Ebola different to, say, the risk of working in a war zone is this is a risk I can control. I can't control where a bomb will be dropped if I'm right now in a conflict zone, but I can choose whether or not I am exposed to Ebola, because I've got to make sure that I wear the right gloves, the right mask, that I chlorinate things properly, I wash my hands. If I do those things, I will be safe. And I know that. And if I get sick, it'll be because I made a mistake. And actually, that psychologically is a very different experience, because it means that it's something very much that you make a conscious decision about.
Paint us a picture of what a day looks like now in the hospitals dealing with Ebola patients in those isolation wards.
As patients come into the hospital, they're screened by a nurse. We've also got ambulances coming in quite a lot. And as patients go in, they move into an isolation unit where we as health workers get dressed in these full suits. And it can be very dehumanizing, because they're suddenly there without their relatives, and it can be very scary for them. So as a health worker and as a human, you want to go and support them and encourage them and spend time with them. But you're dressed up in this mask and they can't see your face. And it's a real challenge to create those human moments of reassuring them. And as much as possible, I'd hold their hands and sit with them and hear about their families and tell them a bit about me, to try and make this extraordinary situation more personal and more human so that they can be reassured. But the work itself is hot, because it's hot anyway and you're in these suits. And you start to sweat, and as you sweat into the goggles, they begin to steam up. It's a strong smell of chlorine, and it's tedious work sometimes, because the infection control procedures are repetitive, going back again to change your gloves and again to wash your hands. And so everything takes a long time and it's difficult. It's physically challenging and it's mentally challenging, but however hard it is for us, it must be much harder for those patients.
How has the Ebola outbreak changed sort of daily life there? You've talked about the things you think about in your professional work, but just in daily life in Freetown?
It's really only been in the last 6 weeks or so, but particularly since the president declared a state of national emergency, that life has been transformed. People here are regularly comparing what it feels like now to how it felt like in the Civil War, because there are curfews for motorbikes at night. There's a much stronger police and military presence and checkpoints. The streets are quieter, and many of the foreign organizations have left. And I think that there is a palpable sense of concern, and everyone's taking it seriously. So people on the streets are wearing medical gloves. Outside every business or restaurant, there are buckets of chlorine to wash your hands in. So life's a little bit harder, but still in the range of normal. But it's certainly very different to what it was like before, and feels a bit lonelier.
There has been talk this week of experimental drugs from the US and Canada. How much do you think that these could help?
It's very encouraging news that there are new drugs in the pipeline for Ebola, because previous to this, there's been really nothing in our armory as a doctor that we could use. So generally, I think it's encouraging news. That said, I think there are two big unknowns at the moment that potentially mean it may or may not have an impact here on the ground. The first is, are they effective? Are they safe? The other thing is, are we going to be able to mobilize the kind of volume of these drugs we would need and get them into the hands of the patients here in West Africa? And are we willing to pay the cost in the way we haven't for almost any other drug? Every day here, we have patients dying because they can't access the drugs that we would have in our homes or readily available for us in our hospitals in the West. The lesson has got to be, we need to strengthen our health systems in West Africa and across sub-Saharan Africa to have good disease surveillance, good infection control, good hand washing, good soap, good gloves and aprons. If we'd had this outbreak would never have started. And if we implement this, we can not only stop Ebola, but we can stop HIV and pneumonia and surgical wound infections and all sorts of other things that are a day-to-day problem, that hidden outbreak that has every day been happening in West Africa for decades. So I hope that's the message we take away.
Thanks to Dr. Oliver Johnson there, speaking to me from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Clashes broke out in Pakistan this week as tens of thousands of anti-government protesters made their way from Lahore to the capital Islamabad. They're calling for Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif to resign amid allegations the elections, which brought him to power in 2013, were rigged. It was the country's first ever democratic transfer of power.
The protesters, who began their journey on Pakistan's Independence Day, travelled in two separate convoys rallied by two very different opposition figures. One, Imran Khan, is a famed cricket player turned politician. The other, Dr. Tahir Al-Qadri, is a 63-year-old Canadian national and well-known religious scholar, lawyer and professor. In 2010, he issued a fatwa on terrorism, condemning violence as un-Islamic. Malek Ayub Sumbal brings us more about Al-Qadri. His report is presented by Gabriel Burrard.
Dr. Tahir Al-Qadri is one of the most controversial religious figures in Pakistan, thanks to his provocative speeches, which are drawing a growing following. Qadri, who commands tens of thousands of supporters through his network of mosques and religious schools in Pakistan, is clear in his message. He wants to bring down the government of Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif.
The revolution is not a flower bouquet or fruit that drops in your lap or on a plate. The people need to actively work at changing their fates and lives. The US, UK, Europe, and even the subcontinent and Pakistan all got their freedom after a long struggle and journey. A revolution needs sacrifices. Only then can nations build their own future.
Al-Qadri's journey towards a peaceful revolution has been long and hard. Previous attempts by his movement to bring down the government have failed, and recently police killed 14 of his followers after attacking his party office, Al-Qadriya, in Lahore. But Al-Qadri says he won't back down.
My followers have been killed. I cannot step back from this revolution call. I will fight for the people of Pakistan to end the poverty, depravity, and injustice. This is a peaceful green revolution, and I guarantee that not a single life will be taken by us because we are peaceful people. This is a democratic, a public revolution.
Kadri's determination to topple the current government has put his life at risk.
I've been told that I could be assassinated by the government any time. They have plans to kill me as soon as my followers start weakening so as to sabotage the entire revolution.
Kadri's plans are fueled by his conviction that the current political establishment is to blame for Pakistan's ongoing crisis and economic predicament. He accuses Pakistan's elites of having all the perks and privileges, while the common people are living in neglect.
I would love to be martyred for the poor people who are seeking justice but can't get it, for the laborers who are running the factories but cannot run their homes due to their poverty, and for all those who are helpless in this corrupt system.
Dr. Kadri has also asked the government to investigate the police killing of his 14 party workers in Lahore. But the government is reluctant to launch a proper probe.
Every day the government is making false claims against me. They are leveling false accusations of terrorism, the killing of police constables, and so on. 2 months have passed, but no first investigation report has been registered for the 14 martyrs and 90 injured of my party.
The government has been doing its utmost to control and defuse the threat posed by Kadri's revolutionary movement. Roadblocks have been established across the country. The army and police have been deployed in the capital and other provinces, bringing everyday life to a virtual standstill in some parts.
All the roads have been blocked with containers and by the police. My workers have faced batons and tear gas, and when this didn't stop them, they were fired on directly. More than 5,000 of my workers have been seriously injured, and so far 25,000 have been arrested.
Despite all this, Tahir ul Kadri is committed to a peaceful revolution without bloodshed.
We will remain peaceful against all the aggression and state terrorism. Our people were directly attacked by the state and they were killed and injured. But we want to show the world that we are peaceful, and the same goes for our revolution. If the government has any proof whatsoever that any of my party workers are involved in any kind of violence, I will immediately dissolve this party and end the revolution.
The words of Tahir al-Kadri, ending that report by Malik Ayub Sumbal in Pakistan.
The plight of migrants from Central America has been high on the news agenda in recent weeks, especially the stories of children who are being sent unaccompanied to the United States to get away from violence in their homelands, such as Guatemala, Honduras and El Salvador. But it's not only the US facing this problem. For many migrants, Mexico is a key transit point. And for some, like the man we're about to meet, it's their destination.
Despite the hardships he has faced, Pablo from El Salvador is one of the luckier ones. Though he has left all he knows behind, he is at least safe for now. Human rights groups estimate up to 20,000 undocumented migrants disappear within Mexico each year, many of them falling victim to drug cartels. Pablo's appeal for refugee status due to persecution is being fought by Amnesty International. James Blears has his story from Mexico City.
Pablo arrived in Mexico City with the equivalent of $100, a small suitcase and the clothes on his back. He well knew it was a one-way trip and there was no turning back. Being openly gay offends many machos, and that can lead to severe beatings and even death.
The motive for leaving was persecution because of my sexual orientation. I started getting death threats and one assassination attempt, so I was heading for Mexico to apply for refugee status there.
A chef by profession and the owner of a restaurant in San Salvador, Pablo was left with no choice but to discard everything apart from his will to survive and hope for a safer future.
Yes, you leave everything, your life, family, friends, partner. You leave your work. You have to abandon sentimental things, material things. You leave everything and come to a country that's not yours and start from zero. You meet new people, a new culture, traditions, and all that entails. It's difficult at the beginning. It all depends on you and the effort you put into integrating into society.
reintegrarse a la sociedad.
Using the services of an immigrant smuggler known as a coyote can cost as much as $8,000. One of Pablo's friends who chose this option was abandoned in the desert. Pablo chose to go it alone.
Mi viaje empieza en San Salvador, capital del Salvador.
My journey started in San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador. I took a bus bound for the border of Guatemala with Mexico. The journey takes approximately 12 hours. I stayed in a hotel. The next day, I crossed the frontier on a raft. I struck Mexican territory at Ciudad Hidalgo, Chiapas. Then I boarded a minibus heading toward Tapachula. Finally, I was detained by immigration at a checkpoint.
Pablo was held in an immigration center in Chiapas from October the 22nd until December the 4th last year, when he was transferred to Mexico City. He was released on May the 22nd, pending his appeal for refugee status. During that spell, Pablo insists he was repeatedly sexually solicited and abused.
Tanto oficiales de migración, custodios.
A lot of immigration officials, custodians, and fellow immigrants frequently sought sexual favors from me.
Pablo also says due to his sexual orientation, he was treated as if he was mentally ill.
They put me into Area A, which is designated for psychiatric patients. Homosexuality is not a mental illness. I don't understand why I was treated this way.
During his trip and his detention, Pablo says he saw unaccompanied children as young as 3 years old, many of whom had suffered grievously.
The majority are emotionally unstable, traumatized, and all of them are returned to their country of origin. But according to the law, they have the right to stay here. We're talking about 15 to 20 per week.
So, given the horrendous risks and the very real dangers, what makes parents desperate enough to risk their sons' and daughters' lives?
The situation, the criminality that's growing in Central America, the fact that children are not safe, the majority of parents send them to the United States. The gangs are recruiting children from the age of 8, and if the children or the parents don't accept, their fate is death.
Pablo's ordeal is over, but the fight with the help of Amnesty International to stay in Mexico is still being waged.
My migratory status is being reviewed. They've given me a humanitarian visa. Actually, I'm working now. I'm established in Mexico City. I'm in contact with a lot of people and associations, and my aim is to stay here and to have what I had in my country, a catering business of my own, and a foot in activism so that I can help people who are in need of it.
Pablo from El Salvador, who's come so far, is now hoping he can finally complete his journey, which has been such an epic ordeal, an odyssey.
James Blears there, reporting from Mexico City.
To Thailand now, where Buddhism is the main religion, practiced by about 95% of the population. But unlike many other Asian countries, where both men and women can be ordained as Buddhist nuns and monks, the Theravada school of Buddhism in Thailand never accepted the ordination of women. So while many Thai men become monks for some part of their lives, this hasn't been possible for women, who are instead expected to live as laywomen, play a supportive role, and hope to be reincarnated as male. But a pioneering Buddhist nun in Thailand is on a mission to change that. Simba Rousseau has more.
At the Song Dhammakalayani Monastery in Nakhon Pathom, an hour outside of Bangkok, six bhikkhunis in saffron-colored robes start the day with chanting before dawn. Adhering to the practices of the Theravada school of Buddhism, the bhikkhunis keep a strict timetable, getting up at 5 a.m. to chant, meditate, study scriptures, and collect alms from the surrounding villages. The timetable is similar to that of thousands of other temples in the country, but it's unusual that this is the only monastery in Thailand with fully ordained nuns. Venerable Dhammananda Bhikkhuni is the temple's abbess.
My mother, when she became interested in Buddhism, she was reading the text and she realized that in the Buddha's time, the Buddha gave ordination to women. How come in our country we never had women ordained?
Venerable Dhammananda, formerly known as Chatsuman Kabul Singh, is in her late 60s and is full of vigor. She's inherited her interest for Buddhism from her mother, an inspiring educator who also established this temple in 1960, the first one to be built by women for women.
It is the Buddha who actually gave the ordination to his own stepmother and aunt, you know, and the whole story is there for you to read. How come we never had? And then on top of that, the Buddha was the one who established fourfold Buddhist, four groups of Buddhists, monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen. And he said that he established Buddhism expecting these four groups of people to be responsible. But how come in our country we don't have ordained women? That was my mother's idea. So when she had enough of her lay life, then she decided to be ordained. At that time, I was only 10 years old.
But back in the 1950s, Kabul Singh could not become a bhikkhuni in Thailand because the tradition of female Theravada ordination had been lost in the country, and the conservative clergy did not want ordained women. In other countries, though, the lineage to fully ordain Buddhist nuns had survived. So Kabul Singh went to Taiwan and became Thailand's first ordained bhikkhuni under the Mahayana tradition in 1956. When coming back, she did not leave her family, but made her home her temple. Although Venerable Vodamai had become the first bhikkhuni in Thailand in the 20th century, it was difficult to integrate Mahayana tradition into a country that's heavily Theravadan. She also believed that nuns should engage in social services, in addition to following their spiritual path. That pioneering spirit was a great inspiration to her daughter, Chatsurman. Coming from such an unusual background, Chatsuman Kabul Singh taught as a professor of religious studies and philosophy at Thammasat University in Bangkok for 3 decades. She published several books on women and Buddhism. She even had a TV show called Dharma Talk.
One day, I just felt that I had enough of the lay life. I had enough of this success. I had enough of this worldly life. Where was it leading me to? You know, I was not really contented. Just one fine day, you know, when I was putting on makeup, then I look at myself in the mirror. How long do I have to do this?
In 2001, Chatsuman was ordained as a Samaneri, or female novice. And on February 28, 2003, she became the first Thai woman to receive full Theravada vows in a ceremony in Sri Lanka. Since then, she has been promoting religious equality for bhikkhunis in Thailand. Legally, the ordination of women is permitted under the present Thai constitution, but the Thai Sangha Council, a conservative religious advisory group, remains hostile towards bhikkhunis and believes that only men can enter the monkhood, citing a 1928 Sangha Act, which recognizes only bhikkhus, or male monks. Venerable Dhammananda believes that re-establishing the bhikkhuni Sangha in Thailand is a spiritual responsibility, in order to maintain the Buddhist tradition, and sees being fully ordained as the rightful heritage of women.
Women have always been contributing to Buddhism because it is women who actually feed the monks. That is the major contribution. And you go to any temple in Thailand, 80% of the attendants are always women. So they are actually the foundation to upkeep the going of Buddhism in this country.
Simba Rousseau reporting there from central Thailand.
And we're sticking with spirited women now, but moving from the reverent to the rather happily irreverent. Scotland's Edinburgh Fringe is the world's largest arts festival, and this year it's seen a dramatic increase in the number of female comedians, up more than 60% from last year. Peter Gagan went along to Edinburgh to meet some of the women changing the face of stand-up comedy.
With more than 3,000 shows across 300 venues, getting noticed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival can be hard work. On a wet afternoon in the Scottish capital, a young lady in heavy boots stands in the Royal Mile's cobbled streets, trying to entice passers-by to her performance. A little further down the street, a musical comedy troupe refuses to let the rain disrupt their routine. Edinburgh, famously, has something for everyone. This year, that something includes more female comedians than ever before. 183 shows are by women, up from 113 last year.
I mean, when I started, it didn't even, you know, didn't dawn on me or occur to me that being a woman would make any difference. I was just Zoe, that's all it was. I guess I started comedy because I had very few other options in life, which is a common tale you'll hear. I'd been to drama school and I'd done a bit of flouncing about on stage, a lot of sort of fringe stuff, and I'd just always loved stand-up, and I started to go to see open mic nights in London when I lived there, and silently observed in the back of the room, and decided I wanted to give it a go. So I got myself together 5 minutes of material. It was pretty horrific, it was awful material, but I delivered it with such gusto and enthusiasm that it sort of carried me through.
This is Zoe Lyons, one of the most popular comics on the fringe.
My comedy is very non-gender specific, I think. I don't really talk about being a woman on stage exclusively. I didn't entertain it as a thought. Everybody else did. I mean, I got a lot of, so, you know, I didn't think women could be funny. And is it hard being a woman? And you're like, I really haven't given it that much thought. I've simply just done it.
Oh, Edinburgh, I love you. I love you, Edinburgh. Things happen here late at night, don't they, in Edinburgh? Last night, 2 o'clock in the morning, I was walking home. I got wolf whistled by a tramp. Ladies and gentlemen, oh yes, I did, and it's amazing how you can sort of turn things around to your way of thinking, can't you? Because I looked at that man, sitting in a puddle of his own making, with one tooth rattling lonely in his head, with his life savings in a takeaway box on his lap, and I thought, you might not have always made the right life choices, but you've certainly got a keen eye when it comes to the ladies. And I like that in a man, stroke tramp, I do.
Historically, the comedy scene in Britain was not very open to women, and the focus on short sets and one-line jokes made storytelling difficult. But at the fringe, shows are longer, and there is more room for narrative. Over the last decade, the British comedy circuit has become more welcoming, says Sarah Pascoe, who started off coming to Edinburgh as an actor, but is now in her fifth solo run at the fringe as a stand-up comic.
What's happening now is the more women that are earning a living from comedy on the circuit or on television, the more women are realising, oh, that's a viable thing to do. And also, comedy's become a nicer environment. It used to be, especially in clubs, very misogynistic, racist, homophobic, ageist, fattest kind of place. The jokes were very, very... Not everyone, obviously. I'm kind of casting wide aspersions, but they were unwelcome in places and the jokes were nasty, whereas they're not... It's getting... Society is changing. Audiences don't want that, really, and anymore.
Unlike Zoe Lyons, gender is an integral part of Sarah Pascoe's show.
In the olden days, it was really easy to meet somebody because you could tell that somebody fancied you from their behaviour and the things that they said. And this has all been completely ruined by dating books and the invention of playing hard to get. So now the first rule of fancying someone is that they must never know.
For Sarah Pascoe, the increase in women on the fringe is part of a wider social change in the UK that has seen a huge resurgence in feminist concerns, including banning topless photographs in tabloid newspapers and addressing the gender pay gap.
What's happening at Edinburgh Festival is a reflection of what's happening on Twitter and blogs and journalists and loads of books that are being published and becoming bestsellers. So it is a cultural thing that's happening in Britain at the moment.
Soon, we might not be talking about women comedians on the Edinburgh Fringe at all.
I always think it's like a wave hitting a beach. It just should be a flood so that it comes to the point where we're saturated, we're bored of it, we're bored of that discussion. And also allowing women to be the whole spectrum of comedy, from absolutely terrible to disgusting to offensive to completely twee, just like the boys, so that it's a complete round circle of it. So that when a woman is bad, it's not because she's a woman, it's because she's really bad. And that's allowed as well. Like, if you have a bad night, it's because I really made some mistakes. It's not, oh, if I had a willy, it would have been fine.
Comedian Sarah Pascoe ending that report by Peter Gagan at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Good to go out on a laugh. WorldLink was produced by Erhard Berger, Neil King and Samantha Early. We hope you'll tune in again next week for more personal stories from around the globe. But until then, if you'd like to hear any of the items featured on today's program again, just go to dw.de/WorldLink or look us up on iTunes. WorldLink is brought to you by DW in Bonn.